Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Allow me to introduce myself. I am Herod, King of the Jews. In time, my family will have a last name because of our ability to come out on top in nearly every circumstance. That name will be Trump. So it shall come as no surprise to you that the first two words I have for you this morning are these: real estate. Other treasures come and go, but the land goes nowhere. And a down market is an excellent time to buy, I must say. What are the three things to take into consideration when determining the value of real estate? Location, location, location. Exactly right. So let's begin with a geography lesson, shall we? The real estate with which I'm concerned is relatively small, slightly larger than the state of New Jersey. Situated at the eastern edge of the Mediterranean Sea, it's a land bridge because here the continents of Europe and Asia and Africa meet. Whoever controls this land bridge controls the trade between all these continents. And he who controls the trade controls the tariffs and the taxes. Location, location, location. Because of its desirability, the unfortunate inhabitants of this area rarely get to govern themselves because the empires of the continents war against each other to be in control. The most they can hope for is that the empire who wins will be the least cruel. Now on to our history lesson. My family enters the story when this land is actually governed by its own people, a rare moment in time, under the Maccabees. Jewish independence is gained because the empires are concerned with other things. They take their eyes off the land bridge, and Israel gains its own independence. And once they've gained independence, the Maccabees push the borders back to where they were in the time of King David. As the Maccabee John Hyrcanus pushes the border south, he encounters the real estate belonging to my grandfather. Grandfather was an Idumean, a practically minded people who willingly and voluntarily allowed Hyrcanus to annex their land, forgoing the bloodshed, and willingly and peacefully adopted Judaism, letting go their worship of their loser pagan god, Kos. Grandfather was already wealthy and influential, deriving income from investments and flocks and, need I say it, real estate. My grandfather's conversion to Judaism was so sincere that Hyrcanus' successor, Alexander Janaeus, made my grandfather the overseer of all of Idumea. When Alexander Janaeus died, his two sons fought over who would take his place. My father Antipater sided with Hyrcanus II, the eldest son and the strongest in my father's opinion. My father remained loyal to Hyrcanus through years and years of terrible battle, and Hyrcanus eventually won, thanks to the inclusion of the Roman Empire in the equation. General Pompey allowed Hyrcanus to retain his kingship, but Hyrcanus focused more and more on his duties as the high priest, because the Maccabees claimed both the high priesthood and the kingship at the same time. Hyrcanus focused on his priestly duties and allowed my father to handle administrative tasks. And my father's political power grew as his management skills refined themselves. It was my father who rebuilt the walls to Jerusalem. It was my father who put down local disturbances. It was my father who came to the positive attention of Julius Caesar. And it was my father who gave me and my brother Fasael our first jobs. Fasael was made governor of Judea. I was made governor of Galilee. And when I got there, things were in a terrible uproar. The economy was in a bad state, and the place was overrun and controlled by bandits. I captured their leader at the Syrian border. His name was Hezekiah. And what could I do with him? Shall I fire him? You're fired. Does nothing to a bandit. So I terminated him instead, on a permanent basis. And what do you know? The bandits backed off, and trade flowed freely again, and so did the taxes and the tariffs. And Julius Caesar took notice of me. Not that it mattered, because before long the Ides of March came along. Beware the Ides of March, the day the soothsayer said that Caesar would be killed. And what do you know? The soothsayer was right. Because on the Ides of March, Cassius and Brutus assassinated Julius Caesar. How do I fit into this picture? Cassius fled to my territory, asking for my military help, pledging that he would make me the king of all Judea should he gain the throne. I pledged my assistance, and word of this agreement made it back to Jerusalem, to the court of King Hyrcanus. And one of his advisors was so angered at this agreement that he placed poison in my father's wine and killed my father. So after I was finished helping Cassius helped me, and we terminated that advisor. Before my father died, I learned many important lessons from him. The importance of political and matrimonial alliance. I saw the limits to where my father could go despite his skill and talents because of his blood. Even though he had married a Nabataean aristocrat, because he was neither Judean nor royal, he could go no further. I had the same practical Idumean blood in my veins, and I knew that I would hit the same ceiling unless I married Hasmonean royalty. And it was no accident that Hyrcanus' beautiful teenage granddaughter, Mariamne, caught my eye. She was less than half my age, but I proposed marriage to her so that I would be part of the royal family. And the Hasmoneans knew I would be a powerful addition, so they agreed on one condition. I had already married Doris, my first wife, who gave me my first heir, Antipater, named after my father. I had to put them away in order to marry Mariamne. I did not terminate them. I sent them to a distant palace. But even simply being betrothed to Mariamne changed my destiny, as I knew it would. Back to Roman drama. Cassius and Brutus, et tu, Brute, are no match for Antony and Octavian, who have sworn to avenge the death of Julius Caesar upon these two. So I switch my allegiance to them, to Antony and Octavian. But then Antony and Octavian turn against each other, and I have to choose between them. Antony seems stronger and most feared, so I side with Antony and dig my heels in, and Octavian becomes my sworn enemy. Stay with me now. I stay with Antony in spite of his lustful obsession with my troublesome neighbor to the south, Cleopatra. She's always grubbing after my real estate. But I stay with Antony until it becomes clear that his goose is soon to be cooked by Octavian. What options do I have? I make a bold move and go to Octavian and pledge that I will switch my allegiance to him from Antony, that I will be as fiercely loyal to Octavian as I have been to Antony. Even though it seems like I am disloyal in the process of making such a pledge. I should mention that this conversation and the trip I took to take it is in the middle of a very harsh winter. But I am motivated because Jerusalem has just been attacked from the east. The Parthians have come and removed Hyrcanus from the throne and placed on the throne instead his rival nephew, Antigonus. The first thing Antigonus does before sending Hyrcanus into exile is to chop off Hyrcanus's ears. Who does that? Even I don't do that. What this did was, should Hyrcanus ever come back from exile, he would be prevented from ever serving as the high priest or priest of any kind. Because just as the sacrifice must be without blemish, so must the priest. My brother Phasael was captured at the same time as Hyrcanus. And when he heard what happened to him, he knew his fate would be far more brutal. And so my brother Phasael took his own life in an imaginative way in the prison, saving me the trouble later on. So here I am in the room with Octavian. If I'm a betting man, the odds are far against me, 10-1 at best. And most likely I am walking into my own execution, dead at the early age of 33. But then Octavian, who is soon to be crowned Caesar Augustus, the greatest of all the Caesars, surprises me and lets me live. Not only does he let me live, but he makes me the king of Judea. I was only looking for a couple of legions to take back to Jerusalem. I was not looking for the crown. Of course, I accepted. I am a very smart man. And I still needed those armies because there was the inconvenient truth that on the throne I had just been given sat Antigonus. So I returned to Jerusalem, and over a long period of time, I finally took care of Antigonus in every way and ascended to the throne and became king of the Jews, the throne that Rome had given me. I've always considered myself fully Jewish. I've tried as best as I can to follow the law of Moses. I could have easily satisfied my vigorous physical appetites with adulterous affairs like other kings. But instead, I walked in the steps of David and Solomon and had many wives, a total of 10 at the same time. Imagine the mothers-in-law. But I thought that with 10 wives, there would be at least one in the mood when I was, which was all the time. Some were for political reasons, but most of them were otherwise motivated. I also adorned my palaces with no graven images. I kept the dietary laws. I am notorious in Rome for never eating pork. Augustus himself said at a dinner party one night, "It is better to be a pig in Herod's home than a son." At this juncture, I must reveal that at different times, my three eldest sons could not wait for me to die so they could be king. So they plotted to hasten that event, and so I had to terminate them. So in a very real way, a pig could live happily without fear in my home for a long time, but depending on his behavior, a son could not. Nor for that matter, a wife, my beautiful Mariamne, the Hasmonean princess, betrayed me in an adulterous affair with Soemus, the man I had left in charge of her and her mother-in-law. When I was away on military campaigns, I commanded Soemus that should I be killed, then Mariamne and her mother were to be terminated so that they could never wear my crown. This was strictly business. But on my return from the campaigns, I found that Mariamne, my favorite, refused to share the bed with me. At first, I thought this was simply because she had borne me 5 children in 7 years. But on deeper investigation and torture of a court eunuch, I learned that Soemus had revealed to Mariamne my termination order. This convinced me that they were in an affair, and I terminated Soemus immediately. And I sent Mariamne to trial. When her own mother testified against her, she was sentenced to death. At the age of 25, she was the love of my life. But I had to do it for honor's sake. If word should spread to the other kingdoms that I endured such duplicities at the hands of my wife or my sons, I would no longer be feared by my enemies or my allies. And fear is priceless in the hands of a king. Because a king who is not feared is a king who is not obeyed, a king who is not taken seriously, a king who is not long on the throne. Throughout my entire life, I navigated the political waters by discerning who was feared the most and siding with them in order to gain power. Once I had gained the kingship, I protected that power at all costs, and the fear that engendered in everyone else kept them at bay and allowed me the freedom to rule as the king of the Jews. And under the decades of my reign, my policies transformed a petty territory into one of the greatest economies in the East, a huge success story. I pushed the borders back to where they were under King David, thanks to my political allies and the grace of Caesar Augustus, my friend. Like King Solomon, I undertook vast public works, building projects, palaces, fortresses, especially on my eastern border, ports, and the temple of the Lord. When my work on the temple is finished, there will be none to rival it on earth. The temple of the Lord is the jewel of Israel, the heart of our political, of our spiritual lives. It is a beacon to pilgrims all over the world, to Gentile tourists who will come to see it, to worship, to spend money in Jerusalem. Don't forget that all of this building pumps life into our growing economy, employing thousands across the land. The temple alone will employ 18,000 men in its time. And people have to have an income if they're going to pay taxes. And Jews are heavily taxed. They pay a temple tax. They pay their tithe. Then they're battered with an assortment of civil taxes. Rome gets some, I get some, and some of it trickles back down into their pockets so they can pay their taxes again. End of economic lesson. What I want you to hear from all of this is this: how I gained the throne of the King of the Jews. And then once I had it, how I govern as King of the Jews. I am the best that Israel could have hoped for in our time because of me. Rome has not sent a Gentile governor over to meddle in our affairs. Because of my political cunning, we enjoy effectual autonomy along with the benefits of protection from the Roman Empire itself. Whenever I sense opposition, I crush it, leaving me free to prosper and leaving my people free to prosper. Life is good. Mostly. Several nights ago, I received some unexpected visitors. The entire city of Jerusalem could see them coming. A vast band of beasts. They had traveled over 900 miles over several months with guards and attendants, and three magi requested an audience with me. Of course, I accepted. I thought they had come to bring me homage by paying tribute from the eastern kingdoms. Their strong boxes were huge, and they were many and filled, I was sure, with massive treasures. These magi are leading figures, spiritual advisors to the courts in Babylon. They are adept at the arts of astrological science, of spirituality, of diplomacy. These wise men knew of our prophecies of the one to come and had discerned in the skies signs. The planet Jupiter represents to them God or royalty. The planet Saturn represents the Jewish nation, and they had come into conjunction in the constellation of Pisces representing Palestine. A star appears whose behavior can only be supernaturally explained. It's extremely complicated, which is why these are the only men that saw this sign. But it motivated them to investigate. It motivated them to travel nearly 1,000 miles to investigate. And so they come to me, and they say to me, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star at its rising and have come to pay him homage." Pay him homage? I'm the king of the Jews. Pay me homage. I should have said it, but I didn't. I wish I had. There are many Jews in Babylon left over from the exile. The Magi had approached this community and asked them if there were any prophecies in our religion concerning a king and a star. The Babylonian Jews had unearthed Balaam's prophecy in Numbers 24 that says, "A star shall rise out of Jacob, and a scepter shall come out of Israel, and one out of Jacob shall rule." This convinced the Magi that these signs signaled the birth of a new king of Israel, and not just any king, one whose birth merited being mirrored in the heavens themselves. My youngest son, Phasael II, 10th son, 13th child, just celebrated his bar mitzvah, so they couldn't be talking about him. Besides, my will is explicit about who the next king of the Jews is. There is none. I appoint it to be shared by my three eldest surviving sons. Whoever this new king is, he has not issued forth from my loins, the only source of Jewish royalty there is right now. That there should be a king on the throne outside my family is inconceivable, quite literally. But these magi have come and stirred fear in my heart, because the fact that the planets and the prophets could be turned against me strikes me to my core. So once the Magi have left, I call in the chief priests and the scribes, and I ask them, "Where is the Messiah to be born?" And they point 6 miles down the road, these experts in the prophets, and say, "And you, Bethlehem, are by no means least in the land of Judah, for out of you shall come a ruler, the one who shall rule and shepherd my people Israel." Bethlehem? I have no family in Bethlehem. There are no noble families in Bethlehem. All the noble families live here in Jerusalem or over in Jericho, where I have my winter palace. Further proof that none of these events happened in the winter time. I dismiss the priests and come up with a plan. the usual. I secretly call in the wise men. And before I tell them what the priests have said, I feign high interest in their scientific art to learn when the signs first appeared in the sky. They tell me it was in the late spring of the previous year. So I'm able to charge them on their way, to dismiss them with words of friendship. Our priests tell us that the Messiah is to be born in Bethlehem. So your journey's nearly over, my friends. It's just a few miles down the road. Go and search diligently for him, won't you? And when you found him, come back and tell me where he is so I can come and offer tribute as well. Shalom now. Shalom. These magi are from far enough away, they've heard no stories about me. Besides, my tactics, my various terminations and such are not that uncommon in rulers of my time. One must be ruthless in order to reign. So certain am I that they will bring back the information, I don't even send an escort or a spy in their company to Bethlehem. Bethlehem, the birthplace of the great king, King David, from whose line Messiah shall spring. I am not from David's line. I am not from the tribes of Judah. I'm Idumean. And I am the king of the Jews. And no brat from any house born under a coincidence in the sky is going to take me or my family off the throne. No, sir. Not going to happen under my reign. And so I wait for the Magi to return. And I wait. And I wait. Until I learn that I have been tricked. I told no one of my plan, but somehow they have sensed it and gone home by another way. I send word to my border crossings and come up with nothing. This huge entourage vanished with no sound in great secret, in great silence. I cannot believe it. How many boys can there be in Bethlehem? 15? 20? They'll get over it. Better safe than sorry, I always say. So I give the order. Does it bother my conscience that I may have just given the order for the termination of the Messiah? First of all, kings do not have the luxury of having a conscience. Did it bother Pharaoh when he had to thin out the building threat of the Hebrew nation by slaughtering their firstborn males? No. Besides, the hand of God was protecting Moses for his special destiny. If the Messiah has been born in Bethlehem, which I completely, completely doubt, there is nothing I or even Augustus himself can do about it. I mean, just as God protected Moses, God could have told the Magi to go home by a different route. Just as Moses slipped to freedom in a basket, the child could slip through my southern borders into Egypt without my knowledge. But there is no Messiah coming. The Jews have waited for centuries and nothing has happened. They've been hoping in a promise and a prayer. I hope in the strength of my resolve. I hope in the brilliance of my mind. I hope in the power of my allies. I hope in the cunning of my heart. If you want to know how to succeed, look at me. The Lord helps those who help themselves, doesn't He? I wish that were in the Scriptures. I'm a perfect example of it. If you want to know how to gain what you want, if you want to know how to gain a kingdom, look at me. If you want to know how to maintain success, look at me. If you want to know how to rule a kingdom, look at me. If you want the King of the Jews, here I am. And if you want to know who the next King of the Jews is, ask me. Don't ask a bunch of Babylonian goyim who spend their nights gazing at the sky and the days gazing at their navels. Besides, if God should ever send a Messiah, if he would tell Gentiles before any of us, that's not the kind of Messiah I expect. That's not the kind of Messiah I want. No, all things considered, I would rather have the power of the Roman Empire watching my back than some brat born in Bethlehem under a couple of stars. So take my advice. Obey the Lord and pay your taxes and invest in real estate and manipulate your relationships to your favor as much as possible. Stop at nothing to get what you want, because if you sit back and wait for it to happen, it won't unless you make it happen. And watch your back. And if you're ever on my real estate, if you're ever in Jerusalem, won't you stop by the palace and pay tribute to the real King of the Jews? Shalom now. Shalom.
When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up. Take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled. He will be called a Nazarene. For our benediction, I would like to read from Psalm 29, verses 10 through 12. Please stand. The Lord sits enthroned over the flood. The Lord sits enthroned as King forever. May the Lord give strength in his people. May the Lord bless his people with peace. Please go forth and serve and know that you have that peace.